This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The District 87 school tax rate is dropping slightly, and Superintendent Barry Riley is more optimistic than you might think.
There are some opportunities for retail development or business development.
The superintendent talks with GLT's Charlie Schlenker about growth in the Bloomington-Normal tax base over the last several years. Hear about an expanded role for the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. The WBRP has purchased new property and will soon open a bicycle co-op. Willis Kern has that interview. And GLT's Judy Valente talks with actor John O'Hurley on stage as the male lead in the musical Chicago, playing at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. You may know O'Hurley as Jay Peterman from the Seinfeld series. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's March 13th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Though financial reserves have been thin for years, the tax rate for District 87 schools is actually going down next year. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Superintendent Barry Riley. He explains why the district dropped the rate instead of maintaining it to build up those reserves.
Well, if you look at our property tax rate over probably the last 4 or 5 years, it's had what I would consider a fairly significant increase over that time frame. And as we look to, the past several years, are the assessed values going back to the housing market crash really went down and took a nosedive, but given that we were experiencing anywhere from usually 3 to 7% increases in our assessed values within our district, and then all of a sudden they go down. That was a significant hit for a couple, 2 or 3 years. And then it leveled out. And then last year it went up 0.4%. And then it went up about 1.85% just this most recent time frame. We really wanted to do all we could to keep our tax rate flat, if we possibly could do that. And over time, I've said this before on your show, our school board has done a really good job of building up appropriate fund balances to be able to address short-term deficits. And so we felt that the prudent thing, given the most recent history, the tax rate climbing as it has, was to try to keep that in check as best we could. And so I'm actually pleased that we were able to keep it. Now, it went down a couple cents. We didn't actually expect that. We thought it would be flat. But the good news is we're saving a little bit of money for the taxpayers.
We have had very little growth in property values over the last decade as a county, other than from installations of things like wind farms, which obviously don't affect you. And some people are thinking that the new norm is zero to really low growth. What are you thinking a little further out, and how is that going to affect your planning?
That's very difficult to project. I would like to think that our new norm is not flat growth. In fact, we saw an uptick of, you know, close to 2% this year.
Modest.
Yeah. I'd be happy if we could continue to see that. Only time will tell, of course. But that's one of those things that obviously we have to keep our eyes on. I don't pretend to have a crystal ball to know what it's going to do. We're coming out of some very difficult times in regards to where those assessed values have gone. You still have the state's issues going on, so it's cloudy for sure. So I think we do have to budget conservatively in that regard and not expect that we're going to see significant increases in our assessed values. And as you know, given our geographic boundaries, it's not as if we have future growth, new areas to develop that will impact us. What I'm hopeful for is as you see things like the Green Top Grocery come into play, you see the downtown hopefully begin to move and improve. We see an example of Hy-Vee that's in our district that's doing very well. So there are some opportunities for retail development or business development. You've got the Landmark Plaza. You've got that stretching over to Tawana Plaza. Obviously, that's a TIF area. But if we see that begin to thrive, we will see some benefit to that even during the time frame of the TIF because of our junior high and high school being drawn into it. Despite the possibility of very limited assessed value growth, there are some things that could come on board in the not-too-distant future that do benefit us and give us more dollars locally.
As you mentioned, the joker in the deck is what happens in Springfield. In most iterations of the potential grand bargain, there is a property tax freeze. Temporary in some versions, and the governor is continuing to stump for a permanent property tax freeze. What is the latest thinking in this ever-changing scenario?
Boy, your guess is as good as mine. It's difficult to read what is happening there. I have conversations with our local legislators, and though they remain cautiously optimistic that they will be able to get something done here, it seems to change and evolve weekly. I don't know in the end what's going to occur in that regard. I'd like to think that, if there's any property tax freeze, obviously there has to be some other form of revenue growth, which, the income tax is one of those options. Personally, I don't think a permanent property tax freeze is a good answer. I think those decisions should be left locally. There are areas that have put in limitations on that, and McLean County is not one of them, or certainly my district is not one of them. And so given the fact that we rely much more on our local resources and our local wealth than we do the state, freezing those property taxes could have a significant negative impact on us, more so than perhaps others around the state. So that's not something that I would like to see unless there is, income that's going to offset that in a permanent fashion.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley. This summer, you will start a STEM camp. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. This is a camp, and I'll give a lot of credit to my assistant superintendent, Cindy Helmers. She does our curriculum work, does an awesome job. She has worked with folks at the EDC, the Chamber, State Farm, and some others. This has been something, when we talk about STEM, that has been infused in our curriculum. Other area schools are doing that as well. There's lots of collaboration that's going on, and that's a great thing to see, and I think our community should be proud of that. We're looking to have elementary school kids, as many as 240. That can participate in a week-long camp that's dedicated to STEM activities. And there, they will have an opportunity to be there all day for a week right before the school year starts, so it really gets them off to a great start. We're looking to train our teachers and to get them to infuse this, not just in that week-long project, but also throughout the curriculum. And, welcome our colleagues in Unit 5 to the table as well. And so really it's a community effort and something that I think will be a great opportunity for our kids.
How do you grow that beyond the elementary ages and into something like Unit 5 does with its growing internship program or other ideas that are out there?
Well, those things are actually already in place. When you look at our junior high curriculum, we have a program that's called Arts for Life that is a rotation that all kids go through. We've incorporated STEM into that more than we ever have. And even the curriculum, there's much more project-based inquiry learning at the elementary schools today than there ever was, and that is carrying through in junior high and high school. For example, we have the SIT conference, the Students Involved in Technology, where we send about 100 of our students to present. They actually have breakout sessions. It's a conference. If you think about going to a conference as adults and you go to a session, our kids are presenting those sessions, and that the topics are evolved around STEM. And so those things are happening more and more at a younger age to prepare kids for the secondary level, where they will have opportunities to be in classes that have a lot of STEM activities going on, and then we do have job shadowing. We have internship programs as well. While we don't have the specific internship program that you mentioned of Unit 5, there's still internship programs that revolve around STEM. And that program everyone is paying close attention to. We've supported that in conversations with Dr. Daniel. We think it's a phenomenal idea, and we'd like to see that continue and grow, not just at Unit 5, but across all area schools. And part of that has to be a commitment from the business community to accept those opportunities for internships. And it's not as if they're not doing that. It's just that I think more time will allow for that to happen.
The coordinating tasks are significant. It takes a lot of time,
yes,
even though everybody's willing.
Yes, and you're seeing when you talk to folks who have seen the kids that are a part of that program present, everyone's excited about it because it has been very good for those kids in that program.
District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Both District 87 and Unit 5 are on spring break the last week of March. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC, offering 26 years of experienced, reputable, and timely financial management with a contemporary, independent perspective. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, it's an interview with the actor who played Jay Peterman on Seinfeld. Judy Valente has the interview. Find out why coming up during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. The West Bloomington Revitalization Project is acquiring new property and expanding its scope of services. GLT's Willis Kern has more on the move back across Washington Street to the former Jesus House location.
Right now, the WBRP operates a community garden, helps facilitate the veggie oasis, providing free produce during the growing season, runs the book bike, and operates the tool library, lending a wide range of tools to anyone who needs one for free. The not-for-profit WBRP will soon add a bike co-op to its list of services. In the studio are Dan Stedman, who's part of an ad hoc committee working to establish the co-op. He has a long history in bike-related issues as the former president and current board member with the Friends of the Constitution Trail. Tani Lathrop is the incoming president of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. Thanks to each of you for taking your time to be here on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The West Bloomington Revitalization Project is already involved in bikes. There's something called Walk In, Bike Out. Is the bike co-op in addition to or in place of this Walk In, Bike Out?
So this year we will be holding the walk-in bike out as we have for the last 6 years, where people can come and get a free bike on, this year it's April 22nd. But after that, we're going to be transitioning to a more focus on the bike co-op, and I can let Dan speak to that.
The walk-in bike out's been great. It's been very successful. We've given away over 1,000 bikes, but there's always been this little bit of a follow-up problem where if the bike, after it was given away, if something happened to it, flat tire, something mechanical failed on it, the bike would sometimes not be able to be serviced by whoever got it. So we're hoping that a co-op will give a little bit more of an educational component to it and get people back riding and also learn how to repair their own bicycles. So we're trying to kind of transition to a little bit more educational.
So how does Walk-In, Bike Out, or the future co-op, intersect with the WBRP's mission? Is this right in the group's wheelhouse, would you say, Tani?
Well, Walk-In, Bike Out has been a part of our organization since its conception back about 7 years ago. And when the TESCA project came out and we were looking at needs for West Bloomington, affordable transportation was part of that. So we've been doing Walk-In, Bike Out for quite a while now, but we need this ad hoc committee to kind of get us started on the bike co-op because this is new ground for us.
Now, Rick Heiser has been kind of the driving force for the walk-in bike out for all 6 of the years. Plus, he collects bikes from everybody, ISU, both police departments, people donate bikes and everything. So we're going to all, the group of guys and folks that have helped repair the bikes through the last 6 years are all pretty much involved in the committee that's figuring out how we're going to go this and how it's going to be directed.
And Rick Heiser will continue to be involved in the this program you're
yes.
launching?
Yeah.
A bike co-op's been talked about for years in the community, and one of the obstacles was a permanent location set up specifically for a co-op. How did this location come about?
Well, WBRP started about 10 years ago, and we got a very small space to start running the organization out at 800 West Washington, which is now a barbershop. And we outgrew it quickly with the tool library and a lot of our other programs, so we moved across the street, which is where we're at now, 801. And we've outgrown that space, too. Even Walk In, Bike Out is run out of a separate location, so we needed more space. The Jesus House location, kitty corner from where we're currently at.
So you'll be in your third house in that, on that
yes,
corner.
Yes, right on that same corner. Yeah. So when it went for sale, within a few days, we had a group of people going in there to look at it because WBRP really wanted to invest in the neighborhood by buying a building. And here was one right where we were already located. It would have more space, and it would allow each of our current programs to have more space and more presence, but it would also allow us to bring in a WBRP bike co-op as well.
And Dan, being the bike person that you are, you've been in the building, I assume. Does
yes.
it measure up?
Oh, it used to be a market. It used to be Eddie's Market in the day. So
oh, that's
it's got,
right, yeah, yeah.
It's down on that main floor. It's 3,000 square feet, so yeah, it's great. The history of the Walk-In Bike Out is that we've been only put in places where the city of Bloomington's allowed us to be. So we used to be in the Lincoln Street parking garage. Now we're in a classroom at the Creativity Center, which has been great, but we can't stay there. They're going to be doing some remodeling there, and so a permanent place for us will make it so that once we have our stands and all our tools and every equipment, we can leave it there and then kind of go from there and take advantage of the size of the building and the height of the ceilings and everything. It's going to be great.
So how does this work? Walk me through the process. I'm interested in a bike through this bike co-op. What do I do? What happens?
Depends what you want to do. If you just want to purchase a bike, there will be bikes for sale, ranging in prices from, you know, we're kind of using the model of the Peoria Bike Co-op. We've been over there a couple times, and they're really great, really good helpers. They give us a lot of good ideas. They charge somewhere in, average price of their bikes is $80, and ranging from $5 to $200.
And these are new bikes, rebuilt bikes?
They're rebuilt bikes. They're donations, so occasionally you're going to get a bike that looks like it's new. And in fact, you know, we just recently had a donation this week that the bike had been ridden three times, so I consider that a new bike. But yeah, they're going to be mostly rehab bikes. And then, so that's one model. You come in and just make a purchase. The other model is that you can come in and join to be a member. A membership's $50 a year, or you can spend 5 to 6 hours of volunteer time. That's your annual membership, and then you can work to earn a bicycle. So either model is great. We're just hoping to get people involved. We're hoping to get the 18-year-olds involved and under, too.
And members would probably get a cheaper price than someone just walking off the street.
Right. There's a discount for parts because we're going to be selling used parts, and so yes, they would get a little bit better.
So you don't have to be a member to buy a bike. You don't even have to be. You don't even have to put in volunteer work to be a member. There are different ways of working this.
Yeah, we're just trying not to turn anybody away. We went out to the LA Bike Kitchen, which is a co-op out in LA over the Christmas holidays, and you know their biggest thing is they just want to get people involved, and you don't want to turn anybody away.
Tani, what kind of research did this group do before you decided to take this step?
We'd been doing Walk-In, Bike Out as a West Bloomington Realization Project for so long that we knew that there was the need there. Every year, so many people show up to receive a bike, so we knew that people wanted bicycles. But as Dan said, there was always the follow-up problem of where do they go to get those serviced at an affordable price. So the bike co-op is going to be able to fill that need. As far as research, I think it was more just of a feeling. We just knew that need was out there.
You were supplying a demand to a supply and demand situation, basically.
Right.
People may think that this is just for kids, but it's really for people of just about any age interested in a bike. Will this help fulfill some transportation needs for some adults or teenagers who are maybe trying to get to and from work or school or something like that?
We absolutely hope so, because you know, bicycling for your leisure and recreation is great. It's a healthy thing to do, and we want to help anybody who wants to do that, but affordable transportation to and from work is a need that a lot of people have. And Connect Transit is great. You can put your bike on the bus, but sometimes if you need to get between bus routes or maybe if you live close enough that you can bike, you know, this is a great way to have reliable transportation that's always going to be able to get you to your job or appointments or, you know, whatever you need to do.
And talk a little bit, Dan, about the sense of pride or ownership that goes into someone who helps actually build their own bicycle that they're using. I would assume that you would just generally be more protective of it. You would use it more. You would cherish it more, right?
Yeah, you're more invested in any time you buy something. And so, and I think that increases the interest in wanting to get it repaired. So the majority of the bikes that fail after we repair them, from what we hear from the bike shops, is that they have flat tires. And if they get discarded by that, that's kind of disappointing. So if we can provide that opportunity for them to get the thing fixed for a reasonable price, even if they're not members, you can come in as a non-member and pay a little bit to get it fixed. And they can also learn along the way. That's the one difference between a bike shop and us, is that we're going to have them right by us showing them how to do it, because it's not a drop-off situation. It's where, you know, you come in and we teach you how to do it.
What are some of the simple things that can go wrong with a bicycle? Obviously, flat tire is the main thing I think most people probably deal with or understand if they're not bike riders, that that's what goes on. But what else happens?
Chains go out of chains and the gears get out of alignment, the brakes get out of alignment. You know, things get loosened up, and a lot of people think that this is like the bike has failed. And, you know, obviously it was in an accident or it gets hit by a car or something like that. Hopefully nobody was on it. But most of the time it's little simple adjustment stuff and flat tires. It really is. So,
beyond bikes, what about connecting the community, teaching and working with kids from the community? What can be gained in this area, do you guys think?
Well, WBRP has a commitment to our neighborhood, to our neighbors, to the youth in the area, and we have been able to bring them in on a lot of the projects we do, either at the tool library or in the garden or any of the other programs that you mentioned. So far, with Walk In, Bike Out, using volunteers to fix up those bikes, we haven't been able to reach out to the youth to learn those skills. So with having when our doors open, people can come in. They can go to the WBRP Bike Co-op. They can go to the WBRP Tool Library. They can access a bunch of stuff all in one place. So whether you're coming in for the Bike Co-op, you could learn about the Tool Library and vice versa. So we hope it just brings a lot of new people in, and we can engage that many more, you know, partners.
Yeah, and WBRP also has a computer lab too, and you know, again, there's folks, I mean, I'm sure they feel like somebody coming in to use computer lab is going to see that there's other programs available to use.
Are you in need of anything special before this place opens? Tools, other kinds of furnishings, things like that?
We are. We're actually in need of three major things. Volunteers. The building is in good shape. I wouldn't say it's in perfect shape. It's an old historic building, and we're going to need some volunteers to help us get up to the standards that we want to be at, as well as just moving from our current spot. Even though it's across the street, we have to move all the stuff. So we'll need volunteers. We will need stuff. We have a wish list of things that people might have and they're getting rid of. You can see that on our website. And then the other thing we need is funds. This is a really big step for our organization. Going from a renting situation to an owning a building situation, we need to be prepared for that. And we want to make this such a great location where we're raising funds. We're actually trying to raise $100,000 in the next few months, which is a tall order, though we're at 48K right now. So we're almost at the halfway point, and we haven't even really opened up the campaign yet. So volunteers, stuff, and funds are things that we need.
Dan and Tani, thanks so much for your time here on Sound Ideas today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Stedman is a part of an ad hoc committee working to establish the WBRP Bike Co-op, and Tani Lathrop is the incoming president of the West Bloomington Revitalization Project. And I'm Willis Kern.
The WBRP is expected to complete its move to the former Jesus House by May 1st. The WBRP Bike Co-op plans to open on June 1st. The next order of business for the West Bloomington organization is to install a new set of officers. That will happen at its meeting on Wednesday. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
I want to ride my bicycle. Bicycle Queen on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some politicians are becoming increasingly negative toward the media and in some cases refusing to talk with reporters. For Illinois Issues, longtime political journalist Kevin McDermott examined what's led to the change. He spoke with IPR's Maureen McKinney. McDermott says the rise of social media has played a role.
The piece opens by describing a tweet that went out in February from President Trump, in which he declared the media the enemy of the American people. That was his exact wording. Obviously, throughout history, and even in modern times, media have had tense and often confrontational relationships with presidents. But this was something new. And, you know, as we pointed out in the piece, that is literally the wording that, that modern dictators have used when they're trying to shut down the press, vilify the press, and vilify others. This was a line that seemed like a very new thing. But one of the things that, you know, I got into in reporting and from my own experience and from talking to other people was that this was really just a more extreme version of something that's been developing really for years, ever since the social media revolution started, both in national and state level politics.
Playing devil's advocate, why should the president or the governor, for that matter, be expected to answer questions from the media?
Because we're the only ones who really, in a logistical and logical sense, can ask them. If you're an average citizen who's sitting out there listening to the news and wondering, well, I'm not clear on whether this person's going to raise my taxes, or I'm concerned about where this person's money came from. He seems vague about that, or I want this policy explained to me. That normal person is not going to be able to go to a press conference. He might be able to call the governor's office. You know, you know what kind of labyrinth you're wading into when you call a public office of a public official in a crowded modern setting. So even just from a logistical standpoint, you know, one of the jobs of the media is to act as a proxy for the public. Say, okay, you know, you can't realistically follow this guy around and watch what he does and demand answers and challenge his decisions, but we can do that on your behalf, and then we can come back and report to you what he says and what he's doing. And this is the way it's worked pretty well, you know, for more than two centuries. What has changed with social media is that the politicians can step right around those reporters. They don't need us anymore to talk to the public. They can do it directly through Twitter, through, you know, YouTube, through Facebook. And as a result, there is no vetting when they do that. When the president tweets out not just threats against the press, but also, you know, just blatantly false accusations like he did, you know, recently regarding former President Obama and the wiretapping stuff, it's something that nobody's there to say to the person receiving, hey, wait a minute, your elected official is not being honest with you here. And that's the danger. They really don't need reporters anymore to talk to the public. They know this, and as a result, they're becoming increasingly bold about, you know, sidestepping that vetting and saying whatever they want to the public, whether it's in the case of President Trump, a lot of things that are crassly dishonest, or in the case of, you know, more commonly in the case of, you know, some of the governors that we talk about, just not saying much at all, more of a lack of information than misinformation.
Did you find that some governors were more cooperative than others? And how does Governor Rauner compare in his level of accessibility?
Oh, yeah. The level of openness has always been, you know, has always shifted with the person. Now, I have not been covering Governor Rauner directly. With him, I'm going by what other reporters are telling me. But it sounds as if he is more or less the continuation of a trend that I saw that started right around Governor Ryan and continued through Governor Blagojevich, and I covered part of Governor Quinn's term. You know, these were distinct from, for example, Governor Thompson, and I covered the tail end of his term, and he was, you know, I'm not going to say he loved the press, but he was open, he was accessible, and, you know, if you needed a question answered, he was going to answer it because he needed us. He needed us to, yeah, us being the reporters, he needed us to, you know, get his message out to the public. So there was kind of a working relationship there, even if a somewhat adversarial one. With the advent of Ryan and Blagojevich both, things were a little skewed there because, as you know, both of them ended up with legal problems and ultimately both of them went to federal prison as a result of things that happened during their terms. And that throws a whole new dynamic into the relationship with the media. Both of them became, I think, paranoid is the only word. I mean, they just really slammed things shut.
The governor in Illinois is businessman first and politician second until recently. Do you think having a business background might play into his level of accessibility?
Yeah, I really do. This is something that we note in the article. We actually looked at three officials, Governor Rauner, Governor Eric Greitens of Missouri, and then, of course, President Trump. In all three cases, you had people who were from the private sector who had never run for anything before and came into office. So in addition to this new dynamic that we have today with, you know, this balance of power between reporters and politicians being thrown off, you add to that, you know, three folks who didn't really necessarily understand or agree with how it worked before anyway. Governor Rauner is a good example because he's just kind of the classic CEO. I mean, this is a guy who's always been, you know, a high-powered businessman. Reporters, and any business reporter can tell you this, they generally have had a lot less access than reporters who cover politicians. Business people have, you know, more legal right to close their meetings. They don't have to let reporters in. They don't have to answer reporters' questions for the most part. And that's the environment that Governor Rauner came from. He really does have a CEO's mentality about the media, which is sort of like, you know, as you say in the piece, you know, stop him at the border and door. I will say to his credit, what we haven't really seen from him is this really, really kind of disturbing and frankly infuriating trend that we're seeing from Trump and to a smaller extent from Governor Greitens in Missouri, where they literally vilify the press on an individual basis as a means of creating a foil, saying, okay, I want to make you the enemy. And, you know, they try and whip up sentiment out in the public that the press is the enemy, which is really ironic because this is the fox telling the chickens, hey, stick with me, I'll protect you. And again, in fairness, I don't think it's worse. The impression I'm getting is it's not worse than the last few governors, but it certainly isn't better.
Reporter Kevin McDermott's Illinois Issues in-depth article examines politicians and their relationship with the media. You can read it at WGLT.org. Governor Rauner's office emailed a statement for this story that said the governor believes journalists are critical in ensuring that government is transparent and accountable to taxpayers. It went on to point out the governor has conducted almost 370 public events in the past year involving journalists, but it doesn't differentiate the ones where the governor failed to substantively answer reporters' questions. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Actor John O'Hurley, who had a recurring role on Seinfeld, is on stage in Springfield tonight and tomorrow. Judy Valente has the interview coming up during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. During Bullseye tonight at 8 on GLT, host Jesse Thorne talks with actor Danny McBride, star of HBO's Vice Principals and Eastbound and Down. Vice Principals will end this season after just 2 years. McBride and co-creator Jody Hill only wanted a short run for the show. Jesse Thorne has more about Vice Principals.
It's about two school administrators who think they're in line to become the principal in the high school. One's an arrogant bully, played by McBride. One's a kiss-up and also possibly a psychopath, played by Walton Goggins. Here they are, in confrontation, the day before a new principal gets picked. They both think they're next in line.
Listen here. Come tomorrow, there's a brand new principal in town. His name is Neil Gamby. And those who want to be catty little b****s, well, they can kiss their jobs goodbye. That is a Gamby promise.
So confident, aren't you, Gamby? Too bad the school board's still undecided.
They're not. They know exactly who's going to be the principal.
Why is this job so important to you, Gamby? Is it because you got absolutely all else going on in your life?
You wish you had my life.
A divorce loser is what you are. Look at you.
Danny McBride, it is great to have you on Bullseye. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I genuinely find Walton Goggins terrifying. Maybe it's because I just watched the first few episodes of the new show, but like, also I watched Justified on FX, and I guess his character on that show was supposed to get killed off after like two episodes or something.
But he is undeniable. They couldn't kill him off. Yeah,
but he is so terrifying. Like, rarely do you find an actor who is not that physically imposing, who is that terrifying.
Yeah, he has a total dangerous element to him. And he's so funny too. He's always flexing these dramatic skills, but he's got a sick sense of humor about
him. So why did you and Jody Hill, who co-created this new show Vice Principals, think that he was funny?
He just has that ability. Like my favorite actors are always the guys who, like, even in their dramatic work, there's like an underlying like wit to them, and I don't know, for whatever reason, just Walton's face just makes me laugh. Like, I like when I just like see his smile and all those teeth and. And, you know, we had a really tough time trying to figure out who would play Lee Russell. I think it's like a character. I think it's probably one of the best characters we've ever written before. He's just so crazy and diabolical. And it was going to take a special actor to pull that off. We didn't really want just to get a straight comedic actor. It had to be somebody with some dramatic chops. And we were searching forever for it. Yeah, we tracked him down and I sent him the scripts. And he was shooting Hateful Eight at the time. And he called me up. And as soon as I answered the phone, he just started talking to me like Lee Russell and like saying lines from the script without any direction or anything. And we just knew he was our guy.
You know, I was listening to an old interview. I think it was an old interview with Jody Hill on The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. And one of the things that he talked about was what he laughs at. And the examples that he gave were like Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't believe, maybe Taxi Driver was one of them.
Yeah, that's our sensibility. Is like, when people are like, well, what comedies do you like? I don't even really like comedies that much. I'm like more influenced and inspired by these other like darker, more dramatic films. And like, yeah, it's like, to me, the average comedy gets a little boring by the third act when you actually have to kind of like invest in these characters if you've just been laughing at them the whole time. And so I think... with something like Goodfellas, like the moments of humor in that are just sublime. I think they're so, it's so funny because it's wrapped up in such darkness and violence. I love it.
There's almost no jokes in your work. Like there are tons of funny parts, and they're mostly comedy, but almost no jokes.
Yeah, we never approach the scripts like they're comedic. We always kind of approach them like they're dramas that have very, like, lots of funny parts in them. So we never write punchlines. We're never like trying to kind of do the normal structure that a sitcom would have with like a 1-2-3 sort of setup and payoff. It's always about the situation and about the character, like, you know, just being, I guess, developed well enough that you can like see what he's thinking and see how ridiculous he is. Or not.
When you say you're not trying to do that, do you mean that you are actively trying not to do that?
Yeah, we do in the writers' room, and that's been one of the hardest things when we put together these small writers' rooms to do the show. We'll get guys from other comedy shows, and they come in, and what we'll do is like the first stuff that they give us, we're always just like, that joke is reading like a joke. Get it out of there, and we Yeah, so we're always stripping that stuff out constantly.
I want to play something from The Foot Fist Way, which was directed by Jody Hill, who you co-created this show with, and was the sort of entree into real-life, full-time professional show business for the both of you. And it's a movie in which you play like a sort of a strip mall Taekwondo instructor who's really a pathetic dude.
Yeah. Say the least.
I mean, you've played a lot of comic characters who are at their heart really, really pathetic dudes. But this was the first time, at least for most of us. This is a scene in which he is in his office, I think it is, with one of his students, and he's trying to get her to go out with him.
Oh, yeah. I know I seem like a serious martial artist, but outside of class, I like to cut loose. I like to have a good time, have a beer or two. Go to a musical dance club, just kind of really get down and just kind of just be free.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's real cool. You like to party? We should party together sometime. I'll give you a call.
I don't think that's a
situation. I don't even need to, we don't have to even go through the weird schematics of me asking you. I already got your number and address from your registration form.
I mean, one of the things that I really like about that scene, and one of the things that makes the movie so distinct, is so you have as close as it gets to a joke in this movie, which is musical dance club, which is pretty solid piece of business. I got no complaints about musical dance club.
But it goes immediately, and this is the hero of the movie, you know, such as it is. It goes immediately to basically him threatening to stalk her.
Yeah, like he already has all of her info. When we shot that scene, you know, we made that movie for, I think it, we shot it for like less than 70 grand. We did the whole movie in 14 days. And I remember that scene when we, what we had written on the page was like nothing. Musical dance clubs was not in there. And Jody just set the camera up and was just like, just pick her up. Let's see what happens, you know? And it was, that whole scene was all improv and it just got so creepy in there. And, you know, we obviously had never done anything before, so that the actress Colette Wolfe that was in there, she didn't know who we were, and she wasn't aware of what the tone of this movie was. And you could just feel it in the room getting so uncomfortable as it just kept going on. But a lot of times, Jody and I will just try to, in these scenes, just like, because we do have such a strange sense of humor, I guess. Like, I'll just always be performing for him when I'm doing stuff like that, and just trying to, like, get him to laugh off camera. And so a lot of that stuff is really me just saying that to Jody.
Danny McBride, star of HBO's Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals, speaking with Jesse Thorne. You can hear more of this interview tonight at 8 during Bullseye on GLT. You're listening to Sound Ideas. You know him as Jay Peterman on the hit comedy series Seinfeld. Tonight and tomorrow, actor John O'Hurley is on stage at the Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield. He plays Billy Flynn, the lead male role in the touring company of the musical Chicago. Chicago is Broadway's longest-running American musical. GLT's Judy Valente caught up with O'Hurley via Skype just before one of his performances to talk about the show and his role.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to see a story of murder, greed, corruption, violence, exploitation, adultery, and treachery. All the things we hold near and dear to our hearts. Thank you.
Before the People vs. O.J. Simpson became known as the trial of the century, there were the trials of Roxy Hart and Velma Kelly, two fictional characters based on real-life murderesses in the Broadway musical Chicago. With a score by John Kander and Fred Ebb, the show evokes the boozy, sexy, smoke-filled jazz clubs of Chicago in the 20s. Actor John O'Hurley, who plays flamboyant attorney Billy Flynn, says audiences have yet to tire of Chicago's offbeat characters, its Kander and Ebb score, and snappy Bob Fosse dance numbers.
It combines the best music that Kander and Ebb ever wrote with the best choreography probably ever put on a Broadway stage by Bob Fosse. And then things that are more endemic to the actual substance of the show, like they both reached for the gun, not something you'd go off singing outside the theater, but probably one of the most creatively organic numbers ever written into a show anywhere on Broadway.
And now, the six merry murderesses of the Cook County Jail in their rendition of the Cell Block Tango!
Also, the other thing about it that makes it so timeless and appealing is the fact that there really is no set. So it's played out in a series of skits that demand a lot of the imagination of the audience. So your imagination is always working during the show. It's not kind of a sit back and we throw everything at you. You've got to piece it all together.
We should say that it takes place in the roaring 20s, the speakeasy times.
In a time that was, part of if America has a contribution to the world culture of music, it's probably that jazz period that came out of Chicago. It is so rich in terms of its authenticity and the fact that it has its roots in so many other bits of now American music that have come out of that. And it makes it timeless because that music is still, it still runs through the blood of music everywhere.
it is an unusual story. I mean, it's about women who murder these philandering men and end up in jail. Maybe some women can identify with the women in the show because they've kind of been done wrong.
Hence the song, They Had It Coming. Yeah. It's a murder but not a crime, yes.
It was a murder but not a crime.
Just because I did it doesn't mean I'm guilty.
Play Billy Flynn, and he is kind of a Quicksilver kind of diabolical, somewhat sleazy character. What do you think you bring to the portrayal of Billy Flynn?
Well, I try to bring all of that. I try to bring his directness, the fact that he is the best at what he does. But I also try to bring a quality to him that I don't think anybody touches upon, and that's a sense of a paternal quality to him. That he takes, when you're under his aegis, when you're under his wing, you're all he's thinking about, and you're his girl, and he will take care of you. Now, that being said, once you're finished, he will just turn you around, spit you out, and toss you away. But while you're under his care, he's extremely paternal, and I think that's what makes him attractive during the run of the story, is that if he can show that genuine sense of vulnerability of being able to be affected by Roxy being scared before she goes into trial. You get that sense of these are two basically two antagonists that are going to come together for a common good.
Mr. Flynn, his honor is here.
Oh, Billy, I'm scared.
Roxy, you got nothing to worry about. It's all a circus, kid, a three-ring circus. These trials, the whole world, all show business. But kid, you're working with a star, the biggest.
Give 'em the old razzle-dazzle, razzle-dazzle.
You have done a number of types of acting. What does it feel like? What does it mean to you to be on the stage?
Well, I stage is my first love, and for many reasons, but the most important is that I love being able to play the fullness of a character. Television and film are editor's mediums. The stage is really the sole responsibility of the actor. It is my job to walk out there, command an audience, and hold their attention and take them through the arc of a character in the evening. And I love that. I love that feeling.
Beautiful personal medium, too. I mean, there's really that exchange of energy between the audience and the actors on stage.
I need the audience as much as the audience needs me. People say, what do you react to most in the theater? And I react mostly to silence. Laughs are easy to get, and you can orchestrate them, and you know how to get them because it's more of a percussion. It's more of a sense of timing, and you can do that kind of arithmetically. But you can't create presence on stage. And so an actor has to earn the right to be silent on stage. And there are several moments in Chicago and other shows that I do where I make a point of not talking as I move across the stage. And if I've done my job, I've earned the right to do that so that the audience still will hold their attention. And it's actually very compelling because I like the audience not knowing what I'm going to say next.
We've been talking with John O'Hurley. He plays Billy Flynn in the upcoming production of Chicago at the Sangamon Theater. Thanks so much, John.
Great to talk to you.
I'm Judy Valente.
And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings.
Chicago, starring John O'Hurley, is on stage at the Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield for two shows only, tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. You're listening to one of the most popular songs from the show, All That Jazz, from the cast recording of the 1997 Tony Award-winning Broadway revival of Chicago.
All that jazz. Hair and wear your buckle shoes. hear that Father Dip is gonna blow the blues. And all that jazz.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. At our website, WGLT.org, find the individual stories and interviews you heard today. WGLT.org is also the place to find the full show podcast and to get started sending us some feedback on Sound Ideas. You can also post to Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News.
And all that jazz. Just a noisy hall.
This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
That jazz.